overcoming difficulties. So I use that meditation because the key to all our practice is having loving kindness, and that needs to start towards ourselves, to have that towards ourselves. You know, they say that you can't love someone else until you love yourself. That we all have these positive qualities within us, they just sometimes get cluttered over by all the problems we're facing and difficulties and things that arise in our mind that disturb us. So simply just start with where we are, start with ourselves. And that particular meditation practice is using our own suffering and then the suffering of others to cut through our own self-grasping and ego. So such meditation practice, or many meditation practices, all meditation practices give us an opportunity to work with our minds and transform our minds. So this is the beauty of having a precious human rebirth, having a human form, having a mind that we can work with and transform. To rejoice when we have problems and difficulties, to see them as a gift. My teacher, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's the spiritual director of our organization, which is the foundation for the preservation of the Mahayana tradition, FPMT. So Lama Zopa says, learn to love your problems like you love ice cream. One of my other teachers says, like you love chocolate cake because she loves chocolate cake. Now, it's very interesting because for my body, I can't eat either ice cream or chocolate cake. So I hear this and go, yeah, but I don't love ice cream and I don't love chocolate cake. So it doesn't work for me. And it doesn't work for me because it doesn't work for any of us. But it is a good... So if we did, so then I thought, well, what is it that I love that I could replace it with? And I do like my morning cup of tea, you know, sipping my cup of tea in the morning, quiet time and so forth. So if I looked forward to my problems as much as I look forward to my morning cup of tea, I understand what they're saying about ice cream and chocolate cake. But these are just temporary things. So are our problems. They're just temporary things. They feel, depending on the size of the problem, you know, they feel like they're never going to go away. But they are temporary. To see it as something impermanent, something temporary, and also something that will always arise, that we will always have difficulties, problems. That's part of, that is the nature of cyclic existence. It's the nature of being born. It's the nature of living, is to experience difficulty. So it's using those and working with them, seeing it as a gift, as an opportunity. So so the practice of generating loving compassion, start with ourselves, then towards others. First of all, those that we love, those, it's sort of fairly easy to develop loving compassion towards somebody that you already love, isn't it? But then you get into like people that you have difficulty with, or first of all people that maybe you don't know so well, you just feel very disconnected from, and then people you have difficulty with. And then all beings without exception. Even the cockroaches and the spiders or whatever particular animals you might have an aversion to, but really developing a mind of equanimity towards all beings. Because the label, either friend, enemy or stranger, is just a label. That just within this life I can think of people who've been my very dear friends, been very close to, who are now strangers. I can also know a few who probably regard me as, at least, you know, a couple come to mind regard me as an enemy. And people that I have had great difficulty with who are now my closest friends. You know, that this changes just within this life. And people who are strangers who then become your friends. And all of this is constantly happening, let alone look at any other lives. So that we, you know, keeping an idea that in all our lives, every being has been our mother, every being, so it's like repaying their kindness or finding a way to generate that sense of love within ourselves to connect with them in a meaningful way. And there's one story that I like of Saint Thérèse of Lisieux. So she was a French nun in a contemplative order, sort of Carmelite, or one version of the Carmelites. So she became a nun when she was 15, and she went into this nunnery, of which there were like 30 of them in the nunnery, and it was like, this is it for life. People you haven't chosen to live with, and that this is it, you're going to live together here like this. And there was one particular nun that she had difficulty with, because she always made this clicking sound, you know, and this was like, they're in silence most of the time, and they're doing their prayers and silent meditation, and it's click, click, click. But it wasn't a rhythmic click, it would sort of come at all unusual times. And so she got very disturbed by this. And then she thought, okay, I'm here for life with these. I'm going to have to learn to work with my mind to overcome the resentment I'm feeling. Clearly, you know, God, because this is a Christian religion, God has seen something in this woman to call her to this ministry. So she really worked with her own mind and started practicing, you know, acts of generosity towards this other nun, being helpful towards her, and, you know, not necessarily showering her with gifts, but changing her own attitude and saying, okay, I'm going to be really nice to this person who irritates me. And then after a while she noticed that her mind did change, that she came to see this nun differently and she wasn't so irritated. Now, the nun didn't stop clicking. It was just she changed the way that she was relating or reacting, responding to the situation by realising something's got to change, it's got to be me. And we all have this capacity to work with our minds to transform it like that. And when I first started, or I don't know if it was when I first started, but I remember it was many, many years ago that I remember going to a talk, and the one thing that stuck with me from this talk, a Dharma talk, was if you want to engage in spiritual practice, when you're driving on the road, let somebody into the traffic. And you can, you know, go a long way with this practice. So I started out and I think, okay, no, we all live in Sydney, we've all got deadlines and you're driving somewhere and you've got to get there fast and so forth. So I think, okay, I'll let somebody in, and then it'll be, okay, I'll let one person in, that's it for the day. You know, I'm not letting anyone else in. And then gradually over time, realising when I got irritated or frustrated with being in traffic queues and all of this sort of thing, and then starting to actually have compassion towards other drivers who were maybe driving a bit crazily, maybe putting themselves or others at risk, and thinking, I don't really don't want you to have a heart attack. I really wish you well, and by all means, go in front of me. Go on, a lot of you. I mean, so to go from this idea of this is my lane. I mean, I don't own the roads. Hello, you know. My lane, you can't come in, to, you know, being really concerned for others. And of course, and then today what I love is that, well, I can't say I go looking for red lights or traffic cues, but it's great because I can sit there and I can do my mantras and my practice, I can do a breathing meditation, you know, and I really enjoy having that time at traffic lights, keeping my eyes open, you know, in case the lights change, because people don't like it if you sit there for too long. So, you know, being reasonable here. So, not a big problem except that it can cause agitation. Like road rage is real, isn't it? You know, people actually, it can cause a lot of problems. I've heard, I don't know if I've heard in Australia about people being killed from road rage, but certainly, you know, people getting other people out of cars and bashing them up and so forth. You know, it can, that's a disturbed mind. So our minds can create great difficulty for ourselves and others, as we know. So it's like practicing to break free from our usual conceptions of like, dislike, having these preferences, you know, people we like, people we dislike, you know, friend, enemy, stranger, and looking that all beings, we all want to be happy. We all want not to suffer, not just me and my friends. And that the people who cause us great difficulty are our best teachers. If you're on a spiritual path and everyone else is agreeing with you, you won't get very far. Because it's like we need others to provide us with the opportunities to be able to work with our minds. So we need to have what we have a saying, you know, my enemy is my precious guru, my precious teacher. And you may not have any outright enemies as such, but people who irritate, frustrate me and so forth. So that we deepen our practice by facing difficult situations, by really loving them like ice cream, by embracing them, by facing the situation. And this, you know, sort of is like, you know, it's university level Buddhist practice, to really want to practice to transform our minds, to work with the energy of different situations. And so just to give an example from the beginning of the year, I spent December and January on retreat in Nepal. No, December, sorry. November, December on retreat in Nepal and India. And then I flew back into Australia on New Year's Eve. And I wanted to get back quickly because we had this High Lama coming who was teaching on this, on mind, on transforming our minds, and so I want to get back to help prepare for his teachings and attend his teachings. So I got off the plane in the evening, and the next day I got sick, and pretty soon I was in hospital, and so I had pneumonia. I was in hospital, and I got a message from this Lama, so I missed his arrival, I missed all of that, but I got a message saying, don't be upset that you're missing the teachings. Which of course I was upset I was missing the teachings. I was in that hospital, why am I in hospital? You know, my mind, you know, doesn't take too much clairvoyance to read my mind. I was, yeah, upset that, you know. And so see it as a blessing of the Buddhas, you know, it's a blessing. What do you mean? Illness is a blessing? How's that? Because you have the opportunity to work with that and use that and to use it to transform your mind. This is what we can do as humans, and particularly as humans who are interested in the Dharma and really wanting to progress ourselves spiritually. So that hospitals are a perfect place if you want to get in touch with suffering. Not so hard. Everybody's suffering in hospital. So really to feel compassion for my fellow sufferers in hospital wasn't difficult to do. It was very easy because it's there, right there in front of you. To let go of my grasping mind, wanting to be somewhere else and how was I going to get out and, you know, so forth. I tried everything, actually. I did. I was there in the emergency and said, look, I've got friends, because I had to stay in hospital because I had to give me injections through a cannula. And I said, look, I've got, you know, friends who are nurses. Like, can't they just do it? Can't I just be at home and they can do it? I thought, and then I can go to the teaching because we'll be there. I tried every which way. And when I realised that that would probably put them legally in a lot of difficulty, I thought, no, I'd better let go of that one. But anyway, so I tried every way and then realised, okay, this is not going to work. And so to shift from feeling sorry for myself in that situation to actually see the suffering around me and feel compassion for others, really just sort of cut a little bit of that ego attachment, and to really look at the people around me suffering physically, mentally, emotionally. And there was one woman who was in the next bed to me, who had the television on all night, all day, and also always pressing the buzzer, needing help and so forth. And you could just see this person was in a high anxiety state, really fearful, really finding it very, very difficult, apart from the physical illness, very, very difficult dealing with that situation, and to really sort of feel compassion for that suffering rather than, oh, she's got the television on all night and I can't sleep. You know, I mean, I had earplugs, I had an eye mask, I was fine. And I had my meditation practice, I had all of that. So I was able to, you know, engage in this, in my meditations with, you know, sort of using this sort of practice of taking and giving, taking the suffering of others and giving love and compassion. And it may not have made any difference to anyone else there, and actually I know it didn't. But it made a difference to my mind and dealing with those situations, and, you know, great respect for nurses and all that sort of thing, because I know it didn't, because when I was getting discharged from the hospital, that woman in the next bed said, oh, would you pray for me? And I thought, I've been praying for her every day, she hasn't felt a thing. So I knew that. Okay, I wasn't doing it like, do you know I'm doing this? I was doing it just, so I didn't say that. I said, yes, I'll pray for you, of course. So although they have done studies and said that people in hospital, even if they don't know they're being prayed for, have some positive responses. They've done studies in America, and actually I heard a report on that here in the medical faculty. So it's very, the power of our meditation, our prayer, our cultivating these positive qualities is not something to be underestimated. We know that. We know when we're around somebody who's incredibly angry and venting it, or even if they're not, if they're trying to hold it in, you can feel it, can't you? This energy, it's palpable. Do you know what I mean? You know, you can feel this heat. We maybe feel it ourselves when we generate that, but the same with positive, cultivating positive qualities, that you create those impact of that within the environment. Now, people aren't necessarily going to come up to you and say, I don't know what it is you're doing, but it's working, so it could, you know, they won't necessarily do that, but it does have an impact. So even when you're doing that, feeling like this isn't having an impact on anyone, even within ourselves, it's a healing process within ourselves. So accepting that we are going to have difficulties is basically simply accepting the first teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha, Four Noble Truths. First, you know, there is suffering. We do suffer. Don't be surprised if you start to suffer, because that is the nature of existence. So that we can be shocked, horrified, or feel like we shouldn't be, or what am I doing wrong? Whereas, as I was reminded by this Lama, see it as a blessing, because you can transform that and certainly use that to purify whatever sort of karmic imprints have ripened at that moment, that I can, in a human form, purify that. If I'm an animal, I'm just going to be sick and miserable and not be able to work with that, do anything with it. But with a mind that is engaged in Dharma practice and wanting to purify as much as I can in this lifetime, it's very, very beneficial practice. So in this way, I can use difficult situations to be free of negative states of mind and hopefully not just temporarily, hopefully more and more permanent, more and more permanent, but so far temporary. And also, to, on the other hand, to cultivate positive states of mind. So that really facing situations head on, not avoiding them, not looking for an escape route, but really embracing difficulty. Not going looking for it. You don't have to go looking for it. It will come. No two ways about that. It'll happen. You don't have to look for anything. But reflecting on the benefits for myself, for others, by engaging in the spiritual practice. And not in a, you know, ego pride way, because that's just going to create more problems. But just becoming aware and connected to the suffering of others. So I recommend hospitals. If you want to get in touch with death and dying, graveyards are good. No, there are those practices. So hospitals are a perfect practice for that, for generating compassion for others. So we can, from that situation too, generate a sort of fearless compassion towards our own pain, our own suffering, our own problems. And
do you run out of compassion?
Do you run out?
Do you do a compassion vacuum?
I think what you're describing is burnout, which is not a running out of compassion. In order, what you actually, it's very reassuring to know that what you run out of is the negative emotions. Eventually, you know, you run out of negative emotions. They are, like at the beginning, so there are obscurations, things in the way. And by paying less attention to them, by not indulging them, by disengaging from them, by deconstructing them, looking at them head on, analysing them, taking them apart, then we actually diffuse their energy, because we're not just caught in them. And the opposite is of something like compassion. So compassion, love and kindness, these altruistic qualities can never run out. And it's like they're there, we just need to get the other stuff out of the way. So that, I was looking for a glass of water. You know when you have sort of, I don't want to shake this because I'll spill it everywhere. But like if you have a bottle of water or something and you're agitated, and that's all the disturbing stuff. And if you actually then just, I've got a bottle I can demonstrate. We love bottles of water for demonstrations. So, this is just plain water, is it? I'm not going to...
It is.
It's not fizzy and I'm going to make it explode or anything. So, you know, when my mind's agitated, it's something like that. You know, it's all going, isn't it? You know, everything's happening, all firing. A lot of mental activity. And then if I can hold it and it can come to relative rest. But I don't know about you, I can still see it's moving. So if I actually let go, it's still moving, but it will come to rest. So it's like this, we're actually releasing, letting go. So we're letting go of that so that then those positive qualities, the compassion, love and kindness arise. If we, you know, try to be compassionate and so forth, that could run out because it's not the genuine. We know it's getting in touch with our genuine nature and that arising. So it's like creating the space for it to arise rather than trying to make anything happen. So just allowing things to settle enough, the things being all our mental activity, our emotions, our thoughts, our memories, our plans, all of that, to then allow for the arising of the positive qualities and then cultivating those, which just means bringing them to our awareness. They're there. Just, oh yes, I do have these things. Thank you for the water.
Right.
So when I was in hospital with this woman with the TV blaring and didn't want to be, the fact that she was suffering enormously and I could focus on that got me out of my stuckness of, but I'm here, I'm sick too and I need quiet or whatever. I can't remember what the thoughts were, they were probably along those lines. So this is what our difficult situations, our problems are, these moments of stuckness. And when those moments arrive, we tend to contract, become a bit narrow focused, and sort of like this. You know, we want to hold on to our sense of ourself, something's uncomfortable here or so forth. And to actually let go, to sit with it, to relax, and let there be a space around it, allows for that quietening. And it's out of that quietening that answers come, we get in touch with our intuition, our true nature, our positive qualities, we get in touch with our creativity so that answers do arise. So it's, we notice our reactions to things, we notice our anger, our resentment, our frustration, our irritation. And it's like we breathe them out, we let them go, wish they could go so quickly. Or we use something like that meditation at the beginning to dissolve them into a light of loving kindness. So it's actually a softening, an opening of our hearts, and being patient with ourselves. So this is what Pema Chodron calls leaning into the sharp points. There's is it Butoh? Or I'm not sure if they do this in Aikido, where you've got self-defense or martial art, but you use the other person's strength and you work with that. And it's like that, you lean into the difficult situations. Our natural tendency is to withdraw, you know, fight, flight, so forth. So fear is a natural reaction to moving closer to the truth. So we can actually, if we can just sit with it and allow the transformation to arise so that fear actually becomes courage. And we can have the feelings of uncertainty or discomfort, but knowing that they won't last, they don't need to overwhelm us completely, that we can change our way of reacting to seeing life situations. And that is a great freedom. I can remember the first time I actually had an experience of that where I, again, many years ago, and I just remember having this interaction with this guy, and I felt the reaction happening, the negative tightening, clamping down type reaction. I thought, I don't have to do that. And I can't remember the conversation or anything like that, but I do remember the excitement of that realization of, I don't have to react like that. I don't know what I did next. I think I just sat there, I don't have to react like that. This is wonderful. That liberation of having a choice, or realizing we're not stuck in these patterns and these habits. So, when you do calm abiding meditation, shamatha meditation, which is really about settling the mind like that, the agitation of the mind, developing a mental stability, which also develops a resilience to deal with difficulty. So there's one of the methods of just settling your mind in its natural state, which first of all is observing the mind as it is. You know, in Tibetan the word for meditation is gom, means to become familiar, and what we're becoming familiar with is our mind. So people come along to meditation for the first time and get surprised that they're really aware of this busy mind, and I thought I was just going to come and be peaceful, calm, relaxed, And it's just whatever state our mind is in at whatever moment in time, and observing the thoughts, the sensations, the images, the memories, so forth, all the moments of mental activity, but observing them without engaging with them. So not jumping into the stream of our thoughts, not being overwhelmed by it, but being aware, realizing I am not my thoughts, that my thoughts actually aren't concrete, real. I don't have to follow everyone.
Really?
That they're just mental energy. They're like pockets of air, like bubbles in a stream. They come, they go, they come, they go. And they're not matter, you know. You can't open the body and find, oh, there's a thought, oh, there's another one. We can't find them. It's the mental energy. So they do arise and dissolve. They are impermanent. They are momentary. You say, well, I wish my thoughts were momentary. They seem to go on forever. They do, but we have moments of no thought between the moments of thought. So there is a dissolving away. So if I don't give them energy, if I don't engage with them, they do eventually settle down of their own accord. And this is what you're doing in like a calm abiding shamatha style meditation, just calming the mind. Because from there, dealing with difficulties, we can deal with those from our own inner resources. That stillness, that intuition, Buddha nature, call it what you will. To look at life situations in the same way. I remember one time, and this was, you know, I think it's used to be, I don't know, still is, some sort of counselling training where it's sort of like, here's me and here's you, and this is the problem, not you are the problem, or not I am the problem. So actually being able to set it aside and look at it and say, okay, Lord, let's investigate what this problem is. Let's investigate this difficult situation. Let's investigate this difficult emotion. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, even His Holiness the Dalai Lama has even written about this, a book called Healing Anger, which he wrote because he had to deal with anger arising in his own mind. To my mind, I see the Dalai Lama, I see the most peaceful, compassionate embodiment of a Buddha. I can, you know, sort of in human form on this earth, absolutely. But he's talked about, I've had to work with noticing anger arising in my mind. It hasn't meant that he's said anything or done anything with that, but recognizing it in his mind. So looking at meditation practice to deconstruct this anger. What happens when anger arises in the body, starts to heat up, or breath speeds up, or certain ways of thinking arise and so forth, and really investigating that, analysing that, and like diffusing the power of it without getting caught up in it. Before you've gone boof, you know, you've realised, not a good day, stay away from me, okay? Or I think I better stay away from the world, close the door. So that instead of perpetuating, continuing on and cultivating those negative emotions, which I can certainly say for myself, cultivated throughout many lifetimes, you know, I've been very good at anger, very good at arrogance, very good at a whole lot of negative, very good at fear. That was another liberating moment, to realise that fear is not an intrinsic part of my being, you know. That it is actually something that you can work with, and something that can fade away or become less or so forth. Yeah.
What can we say to ourselves to transform fear into courage?
Not even necessary to say anything. Just sitting with, notice when fear arises, and just quietly breathing, noticing, where is this fear? What is this fear? And actually, if you even just did the breathing without even thinking about the fear, because there's one thing about like meditation on the breath. So our breath is an autonomic thing that happens in our body. It goes on whether we pay attention or not. Just like our heart pumps if we pay attention or not, or our liver, or all these things happen. But our breath is one thing that also is influenced and by, and I'd say can influence our emotional states. So, you know, if you had extreme fear, like panic or something, you'd have shallow breathing, right? So it does affect. So by actually just sitting in meditation on your breath, without making it happen, your breath calms down. It does. You know when I say, take a deep breath, and you're so choked up, and you're like, yeah, I can't take a deep breath. But if you actually just sit and just think, okay, I'm just going to sit and just observe my breath. And say you were in a moment of fear, you might find at the beginning it is agitated. But if you just think, I'm just going to continue to sit with it and realize nothing bad can happen while I'm just breathing and noticing my breath. Over time, your breath naturally settles of its own accord. And you notice as it settles, then that emotional state settles. So that's, you don't have to say anything. So ways of working with it and not being like I was. I did honestly think this is part of me, that it's part of me, just part of me. There's nothing separate between me and my fear. And by not, it's what I was saying, by not giving it that energy, it actually can settle of its own accord. And then, you know, if there are situations, obviously, where one needs to have therapy, you do that. So we are able to pacify our minds, and this was the main teachings on mindfulness. By Shakyamuni Buddha were on mindfulness of the breath. So really, really using the breath, because you can go to subtler and subtler levels of an awareness of the breath. So if you're working with something like fear, usually fear is somewhere up here. Like, well, when I experience fear, I sort of feel it up here in my body. And if you actually have a meditation where you're focusing on your breath but in your abdomen and the lower down, it sort of gives you a grounded feeling, so that you're feeling the fullness of your abdomen rise and fall, just naturally, not trying to make it do anything, but just bringing your awareness to your breath in your abdomen. It sort of brings your center of attention down. You've tried it. And then if you're not actually completely overwhelmed by something like fear, you can actually then start to look at it in more detail. When we're overwhelmed, we can't do anything in a sort of analytical way. But when that has calmed down, we can start to look at, okay, well, what sort of situations do I get fearful in, and looking at how can I deal with these situations, and doing that from a calm and centered place. So it's at the times when difficulties do arise and our body goes into contraction that we need to be reminded to relax, to let go, and that to let whatever arise, the answers will come. For one time, I remember I was meditating on what my body needed. So I was sitting in a meditation, you know, thinking it's going to be something really profound. Well, I don't know what I was thinking, but it was something along those lines. Because the answer was really simple. It was water. Visualize this water, you know. Quite dehydrated. What I needed was water. But oh no, it must be something more meaningful than water. Well, water's pretty meaningful when you're dehydrated. So we do like to complicate things. So we need to be constantly reminded, you know, the teachings of the Buddha, subdue your mind. So when we're agitated, we can't make any wise decisions, intuitive decisions. We need first to pacify, to calm our minds. And that's the essence of all the Buddha's teachings. And that out of that, our actions then naturally become positive actions because we have a subdued mind, and that is our natural state. So when we do meditate, it is not an escape, it's not a vacation from our problems, from life's problems. In fact, it brings us closer to them. And so it's a time when we can really look at our ways of seeing, relating to the world, dealing with situations, and seeing how effective, sort of analysing how effective we have been in those situations. How is it that I respond to the world? And in my experience, being when it's been a difficult situation, being completely humbled by that. So recently I was in a situation where I was attending a high lama, and it's like, you know, we get it's not like there's a school that tells you how to attend high lamas, and so we all get, the nuns get very anxious and doing the right thing, and, you know, oh, what am I'm supposed to walk in front, I'm supposed to have the incense, but when do I walk behind, and when do I put the cup of tea, and what do I do? It's all these things, it's a high anxiety thing. And there was this other nun who was assisting me, and so I just found her help really fantastic. And then the next day she was attendant number one and I was assisting her, and I was like, I just want to repay the kindness, I just want to be able to help her in the same way she helped me. So there I was, and I was thinking that I was helping her, and it was all good intention and so forth. But all of a sudden, she just turned around and said, you can do it, and she just walked off. And I went up to talk to her to see what was happening, and she was upset with me, very upset with me. And I thought, what have I done, you know? What have I done? And I was completely shocked, because here I was, but I was just trying to be kind and helpful, and I clearly blew it, you know? And so it shocked my sense of myself. It shocked that, you know, me, my ego, was wounded. My pride was hurt. But at that point in time, I just had to go on with doing the role. But then it took me, I think, 2 days of reflecting on, meditating on, going over the situation, contemplating what was it that I said, what was it that I did, not what did I intend, but what actually did I say, did I do, and I had to really go over the whole situation in great detail. It took a couple of days to go, well, maybe that was it, maybe that, you know, and to realise, even though my intention was good, that how it was received and responded to was different, and to be really humbled by that, and really sort of cut through, you know, my... Well, it really showed me my pride, no question. to really just sort of, you know, cut through my ego. And this is what difficult situations give us. They give us that opportunity to really cut through our ego, which is fantastic. Because we have this sort of solid sense of ourselves, and just like our thoughts, our self isn't, there's no, of course we exist, you all exist, you're all here. Thankfully, because I look silly being here by myself, you know. But like our thoughts are ever changing moment by moment, so ourselves are, we're ever changing. And it's like if I grasp onto this self, well, that's a different self to the previous moment, and it's certainly a different self from when I was a young child, even at a cellular level, you know. How long does it take to replace all the cells in your body? 7 years, isn't it? So even, I can't even say it's the same body. Every 7 years I've got a different body. It's great. Keeps aging, though. Something went wrong in the genetics there. So So these opportunities to actually cut through our self-grasping, because that is the source of all our problems. It's sort of grasping at a, you know, permanent, independent self that exists. I got hurt. Surely she could understand I was trying to help. She did not understand I was trying to help. Thank you very much. And she doesn't want me to help her ever again. So, but the trick is not to slip, you know. The trick is not to slip into self guilt. You know, we're good at guilt in Western countries. We're very good at guilt. You know, my teachers, Dalai Lama, came to when he went to India, and when he started meeting with Westerners, couldn't believe this guilt thing. It's like, what is wrong with these people? Oh, he didn't say what's wrong with Dalai Lama. He said what's wrong with these people. That's me. He actually cried. He said it's terrible that people have this negative self-esteem, this low self-esteem. He hadn't encountered it in Tibet, you know. So it was this thing of, why are these people like this? It's sort of like, remember he had a meeting, Dalai Lama has these meetings with scientists, Mind and Life Institute, and it, over many years has been meeting with scientists, and this was where he first encountered this idea of low self-esteem, and he couldn't believe it. And so he was talking to one scientist, and then he asked all the scientists there, you know, put up your hand if you've ever suffered from low self-esteem. They all put up their hand. He couldn't believe it. He cried. So, we, out of all of the difficulties we have, we give ourselves the hardest time. We're very good at that. It doesn't come from others, you know, it's from our own minds. You know, we've cultivated these negative states of mind. So in looking at that, it's not beating ourselves up. It's like in meditating and noticing our minds, we're not being critical, we're not being judgmental, we're just being aware, just noticing. So it's a real challenge not to slip into guilt or to wounded pride, as I'm very good at. So true humility is about really being able to let go of the self continuously, let go of the ego, and like, you know, let it die continuously. So knowing, you know, I don't have to be right. I don't have to be the best nun in Sydney. I'm not even, you know, can I please be sometimes a good nun? But we don't have to be worried about looking good, really. I've got a long way to go, you can tell. We can give the victory to others. In those situations, you know, where other people are claiming, oh, this was my idea, and you know it was your idea, you just let go and go, that's fine. I don't have to be praised. I don't have to be famous, wealthy. I don't have to be, you know, have a good reputation. That is truly liberating. If you can have that state of mind, that is true liberation. So it's letting go of our fixed ideas about ourselves, our concepts, and opening ourselves up to the fact that we are changing constantly, everything around us is changing constantly, friends, enemies, strangers, all changing constantly. So it's a softening, an awakening. It's an opening to becoming a Buddha, fully awake, and calm. Again, it sounds simple, doesn't it? So, just another situation I like, a story I like, and this is about, well, it's a bit like facing your fears. It's not a situation I think I want to try anytime soon, but anyway, there was a meditator in a cave, so he'd gone to do a retreat, and he was as the sort of light was going down, you know, just there was this king cobra in the cave with him, eye to eye in front of him. So you decided, okay, I'm going to sit here and meditate. And so he stayed and watched his reactions. He didn't run away. He also didn't try and confront the cobra. He was there face to face with it. And then as the night wore on, he fell asleep. And when he woke up, the cobra was gone. He was very relieved. But he didn't know if that cobra really existed, or if it was a dream, or whether it was his mind. You know, and so difficult situations can be like that, can't they? Seeing cobra eye to eyeball with you, and it's like, ah, what do I do now? So I don't know that I want to experiment with King Cobra. But it's not unlike what Shakyamuni Buddha did when he sat under that tree, that pipal tree, Bodhi tree, Bodhgaya, and said, okay, I'm not going to get up until I achieve enlightenment. Sat there. And through the process of towards dawn, that part of the night, all the demons arose, the armies of, you know, Maras, which were his delusions, but they came in forms of armies attacking, marauding armies, and that didn't disengage him from his meditation. And seductive sirens and every form of enticement and all the delusions of his mind manifested in physical form. Where did you go? Like the cobra, was it there or not? And he was able to subdue them, subdue his mind, and not be taken hold of by the disturbing images, emotions, and so forth, and really, you know, the hand pointing down to the earth, of overcoming, subduing all these mental afflictions. You know, so we have 51, or at least in the Tibetan tradition, we talk about 51 mental afflictions. Actually, sometimes I talk about 404. I like the 51 better. It's less. But the other one says 404. The prayers we say every day say 404. But it's a lot. So completely overcoming that, and then out of that becoming enlightened. So he overcame them because he gave them no energy. He didn't get caught up in them, didn't follow them, didn't respond to them. So when things are difficult, when we're in shaky, vulnerable situations, it's like that. It's being face to face with these difficulties, and we can get resentful, we can shut down, we can run away. Stick your head in the sand. So when we're faced with those situations that we think we can't handle, it is, you know, the best choice is to be able to sit with them and not run away. The best form of running away, or maybe it's not the best form of running away, I'm going to say all addictions are forms of running away, you know, escape or not facing life situations, and I speak from personal experience. But as soon as you realise that's not only is it not the answer, it doesn't solve a problem, but it only creates more problems, creates more certainly attachment, grasping, it creates more disturbing mental states, it creates more negative relations with the world, and then you have to say, this has to change. So all that does is disturb us more and more. And when we're in a situation where we think this is really, you know, a difficult situation, we think this has gone too far, you know, this is my limit, I can't go there. That's actually, it's a point of transition, and if we can sit with that, it's actually we're approaching the truth. Like Shakyamuni Buddha was approaching the truth, and as he approached the truth, it was like more and more revolting, terrifying stuff came up. It's actually a sign of health, and a greater sign of health is being able to sit with it and not getting knocked off center by situations, by difficult situations, not getting overwhelmed by them. So it's like our spiritual journey is continually being confronted with these difficulties, with these problems, and learning to, oh, it's some ice cream. going beyond what we think we can handle and realizing, oh, actually I can deal with this situation, or I can at least make a little tentative step in this direction. And the way of making those tentative steps is through engaging in a meditation practice that invites us to clearly see what's going on with our thoughts, our emotions, to, like, you know, turn on the torch, shine a light in there, into the dark recesses of our mind, to really illuminate, develop clarity, develop wisdom. So this is why we meditate daily, not to be good meditators. We don't meditate to be good meditators. We meditate to become familiar with our minds, and so doing a bit each day, we become more and more familiar with our minds. Sogyal Rinpoche calls it bringing the mind back home, learning a little bit by bit about our mind. So we're learning to be more awake in our lives. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talks about it in terms of, as you're breathing out in meditation, you're developing a friendliness with your mind, because the emphasis on the breath out is when we relax and open. It's when we sort of have that letting go, is putting the emphasis on the breath out. So we do live in difficult times, yes. It is a difficult world. We've got all sorts of problems, environmental problems, wars, you know, all the environmental disasters that have happened from previous difficulties, all the oppression that goes on and so forth. It's said that we are in a quarrelling age. It's a time when violence and greed are prominent, and there's many obstacles to practicing Dharma. Having said that, you know, here we are in Australia, where Buddhism, in the last census, Buddhism was the fastest growing religion. So there's something in it that has a resonance for people. You know, maybe it is meeting that yearning. It's not we want everyone to become Buddhist, but it's just another label, you know. But to actually have a different world, how are we going to do that? His Holiness the Dalai Lama prays for and encourages us all to pray. We have practices that we do every year on generating compassion in the minds of Chinese officials. Given the history of China and Tibet, you know, historically been very close, and I'm not talking the ordinary everyday people, I'm talking the people who make decisions. And so they've got strong karmic connections. You take friend, enemy, stranger, and all of those, you know, very, very much, you know, sort of very much on the friend front for quite a long time. At this little point in time, it's not quite so friendly. But, and so we do these, you know, sort of practices in wishing that the Chinese officials be free of anything negative in their minds, and they're free of suffering, to really, this is where we say, you know, without exception to all beings. Which again may not have any impact on Chinese officials, but it does have an impact on our sense of openness and developing equanimity, you know, to all beings. Because you can get quickly caught up in the political situations and lose it, you know. But you have to, it has to pervade all aspects of our being.
So you're talking about the difficulty and overcoming difficulty. Can you ask about the tradition, in the Tibetan tradition, where Dalai Lama, whenever he's making a big, when he's facing difficulty and making a big decision, he sometimes consult the Oracle?
Oracle.
Yeah. How does that come in Buddhism? How does it, as in, relate to Buddhism? And what kind of practice is it? Is it a Buddhist practice or is it non-Buddhist practice?
Yeah, no, that's good. So it's a Buddhist practice, certainly in the Tibetan tradition, very strong. And the oracles are seen as beings who are clairvoyant. Being clairvoyant is like, it's a stage that you attain along, like, practicing the karma abiding meditation, shamatha. Pick up around stage 9. You achieve clairvoyance. So we can all achieve clairvoyance. So they are beings who practice, and achieve clairvoyance. So I think how clairvoyance is looked at in, you know, it tends to have this association of being something mystical and something mysterious. It's not at all. I mean, if I was a gardener and I could plan, you know, landscape gardeners do it all the time. They plan out a whole garden and put the, say, if you plant this here and that there and that there, in 50 years that's going to be, and in, you know, so many years that'll be, and it'll look like this and so forth. They see that. It's not there. Or architects, or, you know, they see that. They can make it, visualize it. So that's just like clairvoyance. It's having the skill to be able to see. So just like Shakyamuni Buddha in the first watch of the night when he was under that Bodhi tree, saw all these past lives. Second watch of the night, saw the past lives of all other beings. This is clairvoyance. So it comes from meditation practice to develop that clarity. Someone like the Dalai Lama is clairvoyant. My teacher, Lama Zofa Rinpoche, definitely clairvoyant. And an oracle is clairvoyant. So in a similar way that His Holiness Dalai Lama, yes, he might not need to consult the oracle, he could maybe just consult himself, but you're talking about big decisions that are affecting the Tibetan people or maybe even more, and he will not make those decisions on his own, in the same way that there's a Tibetan government in exile in Darmstadt. So His Holiness Dalai Lama is not, I mean, even though he's got a sort of some sort of political leader head, it's actually the government that's making all the decisions. So in the same way that politically he's sort of given the power to them, it's like that with the oracles, that he works with them, with other minds, rather than making unilateral decisions. So it's the same that the oracles, you know, I don't know, it's not about problems. People are interested in that. Dalai Lama, so you know the process when they identify the Dalai Lama, and this is through the oracle, so they do all these tests. So they might have a certain vision or assume, okay, we've got all these signs and we've read all those signs, but they'll still test the child or children that they think are, you know, it's either this child or that child or whatever, and these are the signs, and this is why this, and this is why we can get this one, and so forth. But they still check it out and test with those, that child, to see, is this the Dalai Lama? So the oracles are used quite a lot in Tibet. It is part of. And it's an interesting point. Is it culture or is it religion? There's a lot of those points where we have to sort of separate out the culture and religion. Like, for example, here am I, Tibetan Buddhist nun, but I'm an Australian Tibetan Buddhist nun. I'm living in the West, and there's this debate that's been going on ever since Tibetan Buddhism has been in the West, whether we should wear these clothes or just clothes like you're wearing, you know, because in Tibet or Nepal or something, it's not so unusual. So, you know, I don't know either way, but so far, this is what we wear. Yeah.
This approach to problems have always been non-violent,
yes,
compassion meditation.
Yes.
Does that actually work in the real world? Because I'm thinking of Burma. Look what happened to the monks that were just sitting there peacefully. they got taken away, they got killed. Mm. Does that do anything towards the problem?
What do you think?
I don't think so. What about Gandhi? Gandhi, it's different circumstances, but in this instance, I don't think it has helped.
So, what you would probably know is Buddhism's a pretty long-term view, more than one lifetime, and certainly more than one decade or one government or military junta or whatever, dictatorship, whatever it's called. So this is the long-term view. So why would Burmese monks not engage in violence? Because if you think about following the teachings of the Buddha, subdue your mind and do no harm. Not necessarily easy, but that's the instruction. All the 84,000 teachings of the Buddha come down to that. Subdue your mind, do no harm. So they're following those teachings to the letter. So they've got to think about, just on a immediate level, how would it look to the world if those Burmese monks did engage in violence? How would it even look to the Burmese people, the non-monk people, the lay people? Would they lose faith in their religion? And how would that be over the long term, when those monks die and take a rebirth? They might take a rebirth as an animal that's going to be killed very quickly because they've engaged in killing, for example. Animals, the main sort of thing of animals is to kill or be killed. And so you're always on that, making sure you don't get killed. And you know, then you've got the aggressors. So you look at what would be the karmic result of actually engaging in harm. And unless you are clairvoyant, a Buddha, and you can see there is some greater good to come from that, then you can. And we have stories where Shakyamuni Buddha, for example, they were in a previous life, and he was on a ship. I can't remember if he was the captain or not, but he was on the ship.
He was the captain.
He was the captain. Thank you.
I read that story today.
You read it today? You can tell the story.
Okay, there was about, he was on a ship of traders, about 400 other traders.
Yeah.
Okay. And there was one villain on board, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that villain wanted to kill everyone on the ship, okay? So what Sakyamuni did, out of great compassion, was he actually killed the villain. First of all, to save him going down into the lower realms, that's right?
Yeah.
And to save all the other people getting killed.
Yep.
The main point was his motivation.
So he saved 399 lives because you can't kill a Buddha. No, you can't. And, thank you. Beautifully put. It's exactly the teaching. So this is what he did, because he could see what was going to, and he could also see this was going to be the most beneficial thing to do. So if you have that clairvoyance, if you have that pure awareness of the Buddha, then you can make that decision. But Burmese monks would probably say they wouldn't have that omniscience to know whether this is the right thing to do. And this is the dilemma that we all face. This is why we have difficulty, because we don't know. So we can only do what we know is best to do. And if you're Buddhist and if you have certain vows, you've got to operate within those vows. And I find it really interesting, because I've thought about this in relation to the young Tibetans in Tibet. You know, there has been some violence against the Chinese, and I've been thinking, why is it that the young Tibetans have, because the older Tibetans never, and so why is it, and this has been going on for 50 years, sort of intractable situation. And I thought, well, they actually haven't had access to the Dharma teachings in the same way that they've been in Tibet. It's been very difficult to get access to the teachings. So it's like they don't have that foundation, that knowledge base of the Buddha's teachings. I mean, this is coming from me. This is not, I'm not an expert, but just from thinking about how can this be happening, doesn't make sense, do you know? And then the Dalai Lama has come out and said, please, no violence, otherwise I'll stand down. So, and older Tibetans hear that would say, we don't condone it, and we only want peaceful protest. We only want peace in the end, ultimately, anyway. But we can understand that, you know, people are feeling so, like you said, it doesn't work, you know, they feel like that. Well, that hasn't worked, so why not try violence? Does violence work? Actually, that's created a lot more suffering. A lot more. So it hasn't worked either. Don't recommend it.
In Buddhist country or Buddhist culture, we respect the monks and nuns, the Sangha order a lot.
Yeah.
How should we, as lay people, react or face the Sanghas who engage in violence? And we did saw some pictures of the Tibetan the mobs going on, and that there was photos of nuns, young nuns, engaged in throwing stones and were looking very angry and violent.
Yeah.
It is
how
very
would
sad
you,
in
yeah,
a
yeah,
way
yeah,
for us.
Absolutely.
But how should we actually treat them?
With great compassion.
Do we still give them the same, do they deserve the same respect that we gave to all the other Sangha community?
I think the question you're raising is completely the point I was making in relation to the Burmese monk. People start to question, is this, you know, and is what I'm seeing accurate anyway, is another thing, because, you know, there's a lot of, we don't really know 100% the situation, so there's a lot of different things. So, but this is the thing, is that we can only, perhaps with an open heart, be compassionate about, I don't know what I do in that situation. But I don't know what I do. Or put yourself in the shoes of. So not condoning violence by anybody in any situation. And really wishing that compassion arises, peace of mind arises very, very quickly, as quickly as possible, in the minds of all. This is the only way that we get transformation in the world. Because if you think about it, if everybody's mind was truly peaceful, we wouldn't be having this conversation. There wouldn't be war. There wouldn't be, just wouldn't happen. It wouldn't factor in. If everyone's mind, it calms. So we do create our own problems, either individually or as a world. I'm not saying there aren't things that happen in the world that we have no control over. Sure there are, but we do have control over how we respond, how we relate to things. That's what we do have control. So, I think we're having questions. Any other questions? It doesn't have to be about difficulties. It can be about anything. Yeah.
Between honesty and your life, I'll just ask this question about one month.
Between honesty
and one's life, which one is more important?
Well, just, okay.
Sorry.
My response would be, it depends, well, maybe, it depends. Because I speak for myself. I have taken vows that say that I'll uphold the teachings of the Buddha and so forth, and I'll have compassion for others, and I will engage in developing bodhicitta, you know, the wish to, for all beings to be free from suffering. And that's a motivation for my life. Actually, for my future life is what the vows say. And it says, even at the cost of your life, so that even at the cost of my life, to uphold the vows that I have. So, for me, it's very clear. This doesn't, but this is where we have compassion and wisdom, you know, the two wings of a bird, as we use an analogy. We have, when we sit in meditation, for us it's the right hand represents compassion. It's the action wing, it's what we do and what we say and how we engage in the world from compassionate foundation. But we have to base that in wisdom. So that's having skillful means, knowing what to do. The ultimate wisdom of the Buddha is omniscience. But for some of us, that's a long way off. Inconceivably long way off, perhaps. Although, as you say, you can achieve that in a lifetime. So, until having the realizations of the Buddha, it's almost impossible to answer that question. Then it's very possible. So then it's like all of the difficult situations we face. And when you say honesty, I have to say, well, give an example of the situation. So there's honesty and honesty. There's also what you mean by honesty. There's brutal honesty.
For example, if someone asks you to renounce your and say that you're not a Buddhist, or similar to our situation, renounce our faith and religion?
Yes. In living in Australia, not a problem. Living, this is why it comes down to actually context of situation, because I don't know the exact words, but I do remember Thomas Dalai Lama saying to, I don't think it was monks or nuns, because clearly they would look like this, but saying to Tibetan people, don't die for me. You know, and then you've got to say, well, I've got to trust the Dalai Lama is my Lama, and I've got to follow his instructions, but it does feel a bit weird if I pretend I'm not Buddhist or whatever. So there was something around that, which was, actually, you don't have to say anything. Having said that, there's a lot of, you know, there have been a lot of people in Tibet who've been imprisoned for a very long period of time, tremendous torture. And one of our Lamas, actually the one who was here in January, upset because I didn't get to the teaching, but then I transformed it. And then I went, blessings, that's a nice way to put it, I like that. Bring on the blessings. So he was one of these, and at one point he was asked, did you ever lose compassion, you know, in prison, did you ever think that you would lose compassion? He said, I think I've ruined the punchline. It wasn't that at all. He said, was there ever, you know, sort of this difficulty that, you know, you felt like giving up or whatever, something like that? And that's where he said, there was a moment that I was afraid I would lose, a moment, I was afraid I would lose compassion for my captors. So it's pretty remarkable. He didn't lose it. He said, there was a moment when I was afraid of that. So he probably just practiced a hell of a lot harder. So you really got to think about the actual context, and then if you think about it in terms of, if I was asked to renounce, I mean, presumably if you're going to be asked to renounce a religion, it's going to be in a pretty oppressive situation. And then, don't have a Lama that you could go to and ask, what should I do right now? Could you please just do a divination and tell me what's the best outcome? These are, yeah, that's, they're very difficult situations. And I say that while we are living in samsara, while we're in cyclic existence, we are always going to be faced with difficult situations. So, you know, we go back to the teachings of Buddha, we go to our teacher. This is the importance of having a spiritual teacher. That if probably in that situation you couldn't actually go to one. But I remember reading, the book is called Sorrow Mountain, I don't know if anyone's seen it. It was a nun. Well, it was actually, she was, at the time of the Chinese, the first sort of uprising, invasion, whatever, in 1950, her father was like the chief of the village. She wanted to be a nun, and so she kept running away from home because they wanted to marry her off, and she said, no, I don't want to get married, I want to be a nun. And so eventually the family said, oh, well, right, you can be a nun. But then this happened. And so her father was the chief of the village, and then he got killed, and then she had to take over as the chief of the village, and so forth. So she was actually imprisoned quite 20 years, something like that. And they had these many times where they got the Tibetans together and said, you know, you've got to renounce somebody else in the group. And she just every time refused to ever say a bad word against anybody, because if you did say a bad word against somebody else, then you could get off. But she did, I think she did sort of occasionally say things like, oh, I took an extra ration, you know, something fairly innocuous to stop them being punished. Well, that wouldn't stop them being punished, but anyway, to stop them being punished, not for her own sake. So for that whole time, she completely refused to do anything like that. Anyway, eventually, I think it was in sometime later, 1975, she must have been released from prison in 1975, and then she escaped, went to Dharamsala, eventually got to become a nun and helped refugees, and then she was asked to write this story, because it's one of maintaining utter integrity and honesty in the face of huge adversity in very, very difficult situations. So being able to, in such difficult situations, you know, stand up for what you believe in and develop a resilience. Because out of all, whether it's extreme like that, or hopefully you're not facing any extreme situations like that, many of us, or anybody really, but we develop a resilience, a confidence in ourselves that no matter what happens, we can deal with difficult situations.
Have you ever found out what happened with that man?
She actually passed away.
You couldn't ask her, would you not ask her? I mean, put it in the wrong way to ask her what.
Oh, that nun?
Yeah, that nun.
I think, yeah, I'm working up to that. Because I did at the at the time, but it was still like, she didn't want to talk at that point.
She didn't want to talk?
Yeah. She didn't want to talk about it at that point.
But you couldn't find out what actually.
No.
The issue.
No, I might somewhere down the track, but it's sort of like I don't want to go, by the way, tell me what was going on. Let me put you on the spot again. No, just sort of let it go. But just,
yeah, I mean, sometimes it's just better to let go.
That's right. And for me, it was just a really good learning in humility. Just a really good learning in humility. Yeah. Any other questions?
Sometimes when you have a problem with a situation and there are people involved and you're afraid to do it, but you still have the feeling, it's probably an ego saying, why am I being punished or something like that, and you want to confront the people. Is it wise to think about whether it's worth doing it so then you can release it for yourself, or is it better to work through it yourself and actually just let it go, because we're talking about letting go? If it's a constant problem on your mind, it's a communication breakdown, and you don't know whether to fix it.
Yeah.
Is it better to just actually let go or try to talk about it regardless, and because you're feeling not really hurt? It's once again an ego thing, probably, when you come down to it. But it's a problem that can go on for some time. Is it?
Again, without knowing the details of the situation, I'm not asking you to give me all the details of the situation, but. So it's hard to just hypothesise, but if it's just about being hurt ourselves, it's where our teachings say we give the victory to others, we let them just have the victory, which means we take that suffering on ourselves, we transform it to help us to develop compassion for others. But again, you know, I also look at the vows that I've taken, and they do say, if it is about, you know, this, that if we have the opportunity and the skillful means to confront somebody else who may be, say, acting inappropriately or whatever, then we have an obligation to do that. We have an obligation because that's having a negative karmic effect on them and other relations. So it's not so much about I'm hurt, it's seeing, okay, that's causing a problem for them. And I can think of situations where I've done that not skillfully. And I remember once I had this boss who was really upset because she was like the manager of everything, and people were gossiping about her, and the sorts of things they were saying were so untrue that in my mind all I could do was laugh, you know. I mean, they were so ludicrous to me. To me they seemed so off the wall. How, you know, come on, nobody's ever going to believe this. It's ridiculous. That's what people do. They gossip, and you're a boss, so you're a good target, you know. Da, 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 da. So, you know, and I remember saying to her, just let it go. You know, people will gossip, just let it go. No, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I'm going to find out who's doing this, where it came from, da, 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 da. Just let it go, because I wanted her to be free of this agitation in her mind. But by going in like that, it completely was not right. Now, I didn't know that that wasn't right. I didn't think I was being heavy-handed. And I probably wasn't. It just didn't work. So then I knew, okay, don't go there. Just back off. So try. And if you try skillfully, but really from compassion for them, mm-hmm. and you have to examine yourself in that, in your motives. Mm-hmm. And you've got to think, what are my motives really here? Is it about, I just want to be free of this? Well, then, meditate, sit with it, observe it, notice it, breathe. But if it's truly about, there is an opportunity there. Because, you know, I'm sure we've all had situations where people have pointed stuff out to us when we've been grateful. I mean, have you had situations like that in your life? And we've said, oh, thanks for telling me, I didn't know it. Like, I wish you could ask this now and she could tell me, and then I could just sort of progress along that, but maybe that won't happen. So, you know, just examine your own motives. Okay, anything in the middle? Okay. So in which case, if there's no questions, I just thought I might read just briefly. It just might be a nice way to close. This is actually, we've been talking about, you know, we transform our minds. We find different ways of engaging with problems or difficulties that arise. And that's the ways you've found already work, and they resolve the problems, don't change them. But this is a text that we use in our practice, a daily practice, which is reminding us to inviting us to take those opportunities to work with our minds and transform our minds. So I might just read it. Determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I will hold them most dear at all times. When in the company of others, I shall always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. Vigilant, the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others, I shall confront and avert it without delay. Whenever I see beings who are wicked in nature and overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering, I shall hold such rare ones dear as if I had found a precious treasure. When out of envy others mistreat me with abuse, insults or the like, I shall accept defeat and offer the victory to others. When someone whom I have benefited and in whom I had great hopes gives me terrible harm, I shall regard that person as my holy guru. In short, both directly and indirectly do I offer every happiness and benefit to all my mothers. I shall secretly take upon myself all their harmful actions and suffering. Undefiled by the stains of superstitions of the eight worldly concerns, may I, by perceiving all phenomena as illusory, be released from the bondage of attachment. The eight verses of thought transformation, which we reflect on daily. Do you have to do some announcements or anything? Or maybe just do the dedication?
show.
Just take a moment. Turn your attention inwards and reflect on the amazing merit that's been generated by engaging in this discussion, meditation, and reflection this evening. Rejoice in your own incredible effort and desire to participate in these evenings and to learn more about spiritual practice and implementing that in your own life, and how fortunate we are to have this opportunity, to have this precious human rebirth, that we have the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha available to us, that we have the intellect and the desire to pursue those teachings, to gain further knowledge, to further ourselves along a spiritual path. We have every freedom to do that. This is a rare, rare opportunity. So we can dedicate all our positive virtue to benefit all sentient beings, all beings everywhere, throughout all cyclic existence, throughout all time. So then may all beings everywhere be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings everywhere have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings everywhere abide in equanimity, free from attachment and hatred, holding some close and others distant. May all beings everywhere experience the ultimate true happiness that is completely beyond suffering. May I be responsible for this by myself alone.